On this week's 51%, we hear from author Breon Brinker about her new book, Skating Out of the Vault, A Trans Woman's Escape from the Game of Masculinity.
I was floating, and even the next day, singing. And I didn't care if people heard me. I knew I was on the way. I knew there was no turning back, and it was a phenomenal feeling.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our guest today is a former NCAA hockey goalie, the current assistant athletic director at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and a new author about the trans experience. Breon Brinker came out to her family and friends as a transgender woman and transitioned in 2019. Before that, she had scored an impressive career in college hockey. She was an All-American goalie and captain for the Kent State University hockey team in the 1980s and was inducted into the school's Hall of Fame in 2016. She was the head coach of the women's hockey team at the University of Findlay and also coached for the Junior United States Hockey League and the one-time Sunshine Hockey League based out of Florida. At the time of her transition, Brinker had been working at Union College for over a decade. Her new book, Skating Out of the Vault, details the tension she faced coming out, but also the euphoria she felt. Brinker says realizing herself has been her greatest accomplishment, and now in her 60s, she feels more confident and more like herself than ever before. Brinker shared her story with WAMC's Samantha Simmons.
Well, the whole metaphor about the vault is that you mentioned the word closet, and that's what's usually referred to, but you can let your own self out of the closet. You can turn the knob, you can walk out of the closet, and you can be who you are. I knew at an early age that I couldn't tell anybody. I couldn't afford the closet because there's too many things that could get away. So I knew that the vault, something like the vault, I couldn't tell a single soul. And the vault has dials and keyholes and you know, levers and everything else on the outside. So I knew that's where I needed to be. I couldn't touch those. I couldn't get out of there, and nobody could get in. And so it was my own world. I knew it had to be that way. It was in the 70s when I realized I can't tell a single person about this, and I never did. So that's the whole metaphor of the vault.
As a kid, you found it hard to grapple with your feelings. And as you got older, you kind of expressed them a little bit more, but still kept them, you know, pretty sheltered and close to the heart. But what helped you come to recognize your feelings?
Several things. I think as time went along, I was really starting to need to be who I was. I was starting to realize that I would have a temper and I would get upset with certain things that I shouldn't be upset about. Like, you know, as I got older with the kids and some things they would do, it might just make me want to just snap or get angry or something. And I was, but I wasn't angry with them. I was angry at the fact that I was so frustrated inside that I could not be myself. And I still had to put on this act. I still felt I was acting. And I was in a suit and in a disguise playing a person I didn't really like. And that was part of that. And don't get me wrong, I liked who I was. I think I'm proud of what I've accomplished and different things of that nature. But it just wasn't me. It just didn't feel. And that was a frustration. That was the difficult part of the whole experience. So as I was getting older, that was one thing. And then the other piece of it is I started to learn who I was by the internet. I mean, I used to go before the internet and cell phones, different things like that. I would go to a gay bar or I'd go try to find a drag show or something like that and talk to the drag queens and find out what sparked them. Why are they do what they do? Do they, you know, are they gay in real life? Are they, you know, different things like that. And I got a lot of different answers, a lot of, you know, similar. But one thing I realized, I'm not a drag queen. I didn't like to perform. I couldn't perform in front of my, you know, I couldn't dance a single bit. And so it wouldn't have worked. But I did keep trying to figure that out. But yet I was in an environment that I felt comfortable in. I didn't feel threatened. And I was very vulnerable. There's no doubt about that. But I was able to maneuver that, just kind of, you know, hiding out. And I would go into places, look at every single person, even if it's a club with 300 people there. I would find every, just to make sure I don't know anybody. That's just the way I had to operate. Now, once the internet came, the cell phones, the media, social media, then I started to find different people, different actors and things like that. And as I wrote in the book, when I saw her story, and it was, I think six or eight episodes, there's like 20 minute episodes, 23 minutes, something like that. And that was the first time I saw trans people portrayed as regular people, as if they belonged in the society that we live in. And, other than that, it's always been the butt of jokes in different movies and different scenarios. And so this was like, okay, you know, I might be able somehow to do this. That was one of the things that really got me started to start seriously thinking, maybe this can happen.
Rebirth is the title of a chapter. I know we're kind of skipping around here a little bit. I'm not trying to give the entire book away to people, but can you talk to me about that, you know, euphoric feeling that you felt when you first started your, you know, medical transition on that gender affirming care is increasingly harder to get, and many people also can't afford it. It's something that's really expensive if you don't have the right insurance.
Correct. It's really difficult these days on certain people. And it was difficult on me at the time because I wasn't really out yet. And I wasn't in a position. It took me a while to get in the position to use insurance because I was still keeping everything under wraps. And I didn't want insurance bills to come, you know, in the mail or things like that. Finally, I said I just had to really take that step. But when I was able to meet that therapist for the first time, and then the next time, you know, tell her, yes, I want to do this. This is who I am. I need to do this. But the coup de grace of the whole thing was when I got the endocrinologist appointment, and they called that script in, and I went over to CVS, and I was singing On Top of the World by the Carpenters, and on the way out of the hospital or on the way out of the doctor's office, all the way home, I got it on my phone. I was beside myself, and it was amazing. The person at the desk said, you know, do you know what you're doing with these? And I said, well, they just told me, and they are pills. I've taken pills. And it was just her way of saying, hey, we're behind you. And people were all looking, and they were just smiling and happy. Because I had been going there. This is like, you know, I've lived there 22 years now, and I still go there, and they still mention that. And I mentioned that, you know, their thing is in the book. Their store is in the book. So, but that was the most amazing day I think I could have ever spent. I just felt it, just literally I was floating. And even the next day, walking around Price Chopper in the morning, singing, and I didn't care if people heard me. Like, it was just, that was the most euphoria that I could ever, and I knew that this is going to be different. I knew I had some difficult times coming up. I knew I had some people to tell and going to have some very difficult discussions with my family and different people, you know, people at work and all of that. But that was just, I knew I was on the way. I knew there was no turning back. And it was a phenomenal feeling.
Did you ever second guess this feeling after you kind of came to terms that, like, you are transgender? Was it ever like, oh, maybe it's something else?
Not a single second. Once I discovered what it was, who I was, Once I finally was able to get a therapist, probably about 6 months before I came out, and it took about 3 or 4 months, maybe three, that to really realize, okay, this is it. I am this, and I am going to have to do something about it. And I was, you know, changing the way I dress, and I used to wear suits and ties to, you know, the hockey games at Union, and I started changing that. I was going very, very androgynous, growing my gray hair out and shaving the sides and stuff like that. So it was there was a lot of things. But once I realized that's who I was, I knew it. There was no turning back. There was never a second guess. And I would never do it again. I would, you know, fight till my last day to stay who I am. I'll never be able to go back. And I've never been like this. I've never been able to speak like this. I can speak in front of whatever crowd you want me to speak in front of these days. So I couldn't do that before. I wasn't good at that before.
I wanted to talk about the process of coming out to your family. You had talked about not wanting insurance bills to go home so that your family didn't see it. So can you explain the process of coming out to your family? Your wife, Marion, wasn't exactly thrilled about the situation, it didn't seem. Your daughter, Jade.
Mm-hmm.
was a bit frustrated, and so was your son, Alex, a bit. Mm-hmm. And your brothers and parents had different views, too. Your mother was kind of trying to mask her feelings a little bit, but then your dad left you a nasty voicemail.
Yeah.
Your brothers were seemingly behind you, but were, you know, scared, but not really scared, but voiced their opinions on what your mother was going to think about it. So, how did you, I guess, like, compartmentalize, like, how you were telling them and who to tell when and just getting that feedback? Because obviously, you know, this is something you've been dealing with
yes.
for a very long time. And now you have to share this, like, biggest secret of your life
yes.
with the people you love the most.
Yes. And the biggest thing is with my therapist, I knew we put together a plan. And I put together a plan and she's said, you know, well, you know, obviously your wife has to be first, which I knew. And you know, pretty good. And then, you know, my kids, my parents, I didn't want anybody close to me to find out through the grapevine. I didn't want them to find out secondhand, third hand. And that was a huge, huge issue to me. And I wanted it to go properly on campus. You know, I needed to be up, you know, go up the ladder, and then, you know, different ways, you know, in that stratosphere, and then the people below me that worked for me and things like that nature. So it was, that was the most organized thing I've ever done in my life. I that's not my strength necessarily, organization. I'm in various circumstances I can come through, but that was the, I had that pinpoint, I had it down, and I was able to handle that. Yeah, Marion didn't love it, but she sensed something. She saw the changes in me. She just thought I was going to say I'm queer, you know, I'm gay and stuff like that. And you know, when she said, hey, I'm not a lesbian. But then in that same conversation, we stood up, and she's going through chemo now, stood up in the kitchen for about 3 hours talking about this. And she was trying to get me to, you know, to say a name, you know, like have my name, you know, keep the same initial and stuff. I said, yeah, I've got my name, you know, thanks for the help there, but I know who I am. I know. And just, you know, we started thinking up strategies right there about how to tell the kids, when to tell the kids. And it was, that was great. My mom was probably a 2.5 hour phone call. I went to my brother's first to try to, you know, because I figured I'd have a little bit easier time. And, you know, they were, at least they were supportive of me, and they wanted to be there with my parents when I told them. And that was the toughest thing. I dreaded all week making that phone call, but it worked. At least I said what I needed to say. And yeah, she didn't like it. She hates it now, But that process was difficult. The worst part about it was Jade, when she really didn't like it. And she was 16 and she was at boarding school. And
you said it was in the book, you said it was the worst day of your life.
Worst day. It was the worst. Yeah, it was the worst. And it was the worst predicament of that entire of the entire journey. The rest of anybody I could have gotten through, but that one was the most difficult. But thankfully, she's 100% on my side now. And It's been amazing.
For those of you who are just joining us, we're speaking with Breon Brinker about her new book called Skating Out of the Vault.
You have, you know, a large involvement with D1 athletics at Union College, and you've been involved in collegiate sports elsewhere. You came out to your colleagues slowly and strategically, which we just talked about. Yeah. But in the sports world itself, you talk about getting inducted into a couple halls of fame and that being a decision on, you know, how you wanted to go about that. How did it feel in the sports world? Could be because, you know, that is your life. That is how you grew up and what you wanted to do with your career and what you are doing with your career.
Yeah, it was terrifying. It was really terrifying. And even back when I knew I really wanted to be, you know, once I realized I'm not getting drafted or pros at age 17 or 18. I knew I was going to be going to college. I wanted to be there. I wanted to get, you know, play the highest level I could possibly play. And I knew that not a word of this, but had I, you know, went ahead and, okay, changed my gender, which in those days you just didn't talk about. Girls hockey wasn't really developed at that point in time. So I thought, you know, hockey would be over, especially where I was from in St. Louis. There really wasn't very many girls playing at all, if any. I just don't remember many. I'm probably missing somebody or two. But whenever there was, you know, let's beat the shit out of her. You know, let's you know, run her. You know, let's knock her out of the game. And, like, what good is that? You know, like, what is that all about? But all those types of little things just kept me right where I was. And but, yeah, it's playing both sides, you know, I mean, just opposite ends of the – you know, toughness, you know, machismo in one end, and then just being, you know, caring and trying to be the best person I can in the other. And it was a balancing act. And again, I was acting. There was times I didn't want to stand up for somebody if they're, you know, if they're saying, oh, look, that queer person, you this and that. And I didn't have the guts to stand up. And part of it was, if I stood up for them, why they're going to say, why are you standing up for them? Are you queer too? That was what was going through my mind. But I just didn't have I just wasn't brave enough for that. I just was doing everything I could to stay in that vault, to stay safe. And that was a big part of that.
You talk in the book about your Team Trans hockey team. And then before we started this interview, we talked about, you know, the importance of community. So how has that supported you in your transition?
Well, I think it was amazing. That's one of the high points of my life, being able to go play with Team Trans. I'm sure we have over 200 people right now on our, you know, program, from coast to coast in the United States, coast to coast in Canada. They're all over the place. Some people I haven't even met in person. They're just, you know, we're on socials or something like that. But there's a lot of people I've met, I've got to be very close with. It's an amazing, euphoric feeling to be around that. And I don't have to be around just queer people or trans people or anything like that. But when we do, there's just something special about it. And it you can say things, you can talk about things, you can talk about your meds, you can talk about your surgeries, you can talk about, without having to worry about what these cis people are thinking. You know, because it's just, you know, there's just a comfort level that, like, anything goes. And so that is just wonderful. And just, we know everybody there has a story, has had a difficult road, maybe going through a difficult road. Some people have lost jobs because of who they are, family members, you know, friends, communities themselves. And then others are doing terrific and thriving, and they're such amazing role models. There's just so much there, and we're all, you know, together. I think the one thing that's really striking me the past two, three different tournaments that I've gone to with those is there's a lot of the trans people that have quit hockey as a kid in high school or something like that, and they all have a similar story that, you know, just they couldn't handle the machismo, didn't want, you know, I mean, that it was too much. There was the teammates or the coach was too just too overbearing and things like that. And I think that might be, if I do another book, that might be part of the a topic that I pick, you know, why people quit, why people, you know, why queer people quit. I haven't formed it yet, but that's going through my head because there's just too many stories about that. And there's just too many good people quitting the sport. Talented people, not just, you know, I mean, these people have skills, and so that shouldn't happen. There's just such amazing people. There's some brilliant people that are in this in our community, and that in with the Team Trans, it's there's just a closeness with many of them that just it's tough to describe.
A chunk of the book dealt with the oppression of minorities, so why did you feel that that should be included as a part of your story?
Well, because I went through life as a cis white dude. And I also realized that not everybody had the privilege. I didn't realize the privilege I had. I really didn't. And growing up in St. Louis through high school, everything, I mean, there was one black kid in our high school. I know how people talked about black people. I know how people talked about queer people. The N-word was said often and even in college. But then I was in school with more people of color and got to know people that were Asian and, you know, Middle Eastern and different things like that. And I had no idea what to think. Like, it really changed my world. It changed my line of thinking. And I just did not want to go back to where I was. And I wanted to be able to say, look, we're not the only ones that are getting oppressed here, that the government's trying to dismantle and get rid of and things. There's plenty of people in the same boat. And I just, we're not the only ones. I'm not the only one. And I think that there's a lot of people that with privilege that could really make a difference. And I also wanted to somehow, you know, if it gives strength to those people that are you know, that feel oppressed, that feel scared, that feel like they're on the fringes or something like that, I want to make sure they you know, see a success story, see somebody thrive.
And lastly, was there any sort of, you know, unexpected changes or surprises with your transition? Was there anything that, you know, you hadn't thought of already? Like, obviously you said this has been, you know, the telling to people was the most organized thing you've done in your life. I'm sure a lot of this was the most organized you've ever been.
Yeah.
So is there anything that kind of threw you for a loop at all?
That's a good question. My boss actually, well, one thing that just comes to mind is, when I was going through, and I was going through telling people, and I didn't tell my boss right. I was getting ready to tell my boss, and he had never given me any reason to think he wouldn't be supportive. Never did or said anything that he wouldn't. However, he was still an ex college football player. He was a frat person, and so it's just that piece of it. And he was a dude. And he was probably the first man I told, and I didn't sleep the night before, and I was, you know, pretty scared. So I went in and told him, and the first thing he says, "Oh, well, okay, I didn't really know, but how can I help? How can I help you? How can I support you?" And I wasn't ready for that answer. I didn't have an answer. I was more worried about getting this out, and I'm thinking, well, just call me by my name, if you can call me by my name and use my pronouns and just treat me like you would. And, I just think it's business as usual. And that's it. And so that's kind of the way. So that was one. I just really wasn't ready for that particular question. And I feel more aware. I think I was more, you know, ready for different things. Nothing's coming to mind that was overwhelming for me. Everything was more, I would say, if anything, there was things that were euphoric for me. It was just being able to, you know, when I first got my got an email about, you know, going to a women's conference, I was, the fact that I'm thinking, okay, women's conference, this is going to be, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I was invited to this. I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to being included. And so there's a lot of those things that, you know, I'm included and I'm just like, whoa. And some people I felt like I was, you know, getting, you know, talking with the Latin dance community too. There's just so much, there's so much community there. There's so many people that reach out. And just, you know, we do a, you know, birthday party. I'm included in those now. And it's just, I didn't go in there thinking that would even happen. I just thought I'd learn how to dance and I didn't know where it was going to go. And I'm now performing and hanging out with different groups of people. So, that's a difficult one, but other than it just every day is a joy. I love who I look at in the mirror. So I don't know if anything overwhelms me like that.
And I might've said lastly on the last question, but I'm going to say it again.
It's okay.
If you could give, you know, a piece of advice to anyone who is maybe in that in-between phase where they're not really sure how they're feeling or is starting their transition or is maybe at the same point that you are, what would you say to them now? Or what would you say to yourself now?
Well, myself, I know who I am. I love who I am. And so, but I think that the big thing is find community, find somebody to talk to, get therapy. I think therapy should be normalized. It should not be a big deal. It should not be, it should not have the stigma it used to have. And I think it's going that way. I don't find that people talk about therapy in the same way they used to. And I think that's great and it's healthy. And I think everybody should embrace that. I think there's some people like, I don't want to tell a stranger my, I said, that's the easiest one. You tell a stranger. That's when, you know, that's how it made it easy. When I was like looking for clothing and stuff to kind of wear, it was easier to go to a place where I didn't know anyone. And then they'd never see me again until I went back. And then I became a regular and we got to be friends. And I'm still friends with people. I just sold a book and signed one for a person who's a friend to a place that I was going for 13 years. And an unbelievable ally, didn't know anything about this before. And it's really cool. But I think that just reach out. Don't be afraid to find, you know, people. Don't hide your voice if you can help it.
That was Breon Brinker, Assistant Athletic Director at Union College, speaking with WAMC Samantha Simmons. Brinker's new book is Skating Out of the Vault, A Trans Woman's Escape from the Game of Masculinity. It's out now through TM Center Publishing. You can learn more about Brinker's work and hockey career at unionathletics.com. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. A nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet bells and little girls.